Is this Mr. David?
No, he went to the moon. He took a trip to the moon.
Well, actually, I'm on the moon and I don't see him.
Well,
I'm calling from the moon.
Look for the areas where you farm all the blue cheese. Yeah. So, how you doing, Mr. Geo?
Right now, I'm delusional and I'm suffering from catching mental illness from my friends.
I see. I understand. Yeah. I caught mental illness from a friend a long time ago, I believe.
I think he probably did. I think he's been trying to give it to me. He said, you should be so lucky.
He said that?
I think maybe he said it or I said it.
See, already you're losing the
perspective.
You're losing your mind, but you don't know who says a thing.
Right.
You are the other person.
Maybe I am the other person.
Maybe you are. When I used to get sick, I used to always have this little trick I used to tell myself. Today is everybody else's day. Today is everybody else's day. We all trade personalities. I used to fool around with that nonsense.
And what was that like?
It was just a saying of mine. I don't know where it came from. Who knows where these things come from? But I used to play with that, you know.
I'm trying to understand it. Today is everybody...
Is everybody else day.
Day.
The old trade personality. I mean, I go through that sometimes. I feel like I'm being absorbed by other people's personalities somehow, and I become them. And it's hard to find my own... I mentioned that to you before. It's very hard to find my own self now. I have a friend who talks about her having multiple personalities. And maybe that's something about where that comes from. She even went under hypnosis at a hospital. And they had her talk, and they had her talking to voices of these various personalities. They asked them their names, and each one had a characteristic, they all had, they really got into her multiple personalities. And she heard the tape. I mean, she didn't realize she was saying it, but she heard the tape, and she was telling them, oh, I am... mentioned her name and said, this is what I do, you know, this is what I do for Julia. And very strange thing, very, very eerie. But sometimes I get into, like, I can't find myself. I feel like I'm becoming other people. And I can't really find my own identity. I don't go so far as to having multiple personalities, but with my friend who I mentioned, I guess it's a very intense experience for her. When she gets upset, she always feels she's going back to her multiple personalities.
Oh, I thought it was delusional for a second. Hold it a second. I just got an email from my daughter.
Oh, great.
Nothing new to report. Damn it. I'm just trying to take some advice from James.
Yeah.
Called Simplify. Not doing too good at it. But I'm trying to unload a couple of things, and I'm not doing too good at that either.
Yeah.
Talk about multiple personalities. So when I play back these things to you, you think you'll recognize who was talking?
Of course.
You think so?
Of course.
Oh, damn it. How are you otherwise?
What I've done, instead of, I think this loss of self has to do with perhaps a lack of, maybe it's like a depression kind of thing. I've always heard that depression is anger at yourself. It's disguised anger at yourself. You hurt yourself because you feel you did something wrong. And maybe this loss of identity is my depression's way of working into despising my own personality, so I have to become other people. And what I really try to do rather than become other people is become... not become the words of the Bible, but fill my head with the words of the Bible and the Buddhist scriptures and the Hindu scriptures and the Quran. And I fill my head with all those things because I feel that's a good way to go. It's a good way to become absorbed into the personality of the books, of the word.
But I've noticed when you're with people, most people think you're not. You know, I look at them and they look. You know, you're off looking out in space, and you're kind of absorbed in that space that you sometimes.
Yeah.
But I'm always amazed at how you're actually really listening, aren't you?
Oh, sure, I listen. That's how I listen. I focus. That's
yeah.
My focus. I'm really listening. I do listen to what people say.
No, I know. I'm
but I also try to listen with a sense of what it means in terms of the structure of the word to a certain extent. I mean, that's how I focus. I kind of like listen, trying to find out what the person is really saying in terms of the largest scheme. Sometimes I do that, but I that's how I listen. I don't really look into a person. I can't concentrate if I look into a person's face. I listen that way. I always listen to what people say.
Yeah, I notice that. Do you have one good ear that's better than the other?
I don't know. Why?
No, but sometimes you look off to the left.
Look off to the left? Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah. But I've noticed that you know you don't look at people sometimes when you're listening.
Well, when I'm really listening, I usually don't look at people because I can get caught up with the personality of the face rather than the content of the words. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Words for some reason are always more important than visuals. As you can tell, I mean, sound somehow to me is always more important in the visual sense because. Like I don't watch TV, I don't watch movies, I don't believe in the moving image media. I believe in the sound image media more. I'm always listening to music, and I'm always writing words that somehow you can hear with the inner ear. I mean, that's more what I'm into. I'm not so much into the visuals. I don't know if that has to do with it. I had a lot of deafness in my family, so maybe hearing is important to me.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, my grandfather, when I was a child, supposedly my mother tells me we were inseparable, and he had a big ear horn because he was just about stone deaf, and you had to kind of like shout into the ear horn for him to hear anything. And he used to say things, and people didn't understand him. My mother told me I used to always interpret what he said. I would always interpret what he said. I always somehow always knew what he meant, and I, even though I was only like 3 years old, I always made sense of what he was saying. That you know, because he was like in his 80s, and he didn't always make sense, but somehow I intuitively knew what he was talking about, and we were supposed to be inseparable. And then he lived two doors down, and he was always over. I just remember as a very kind man in his room. The room, he had his own room with a big roll-top desk, and he had all religious statues and paintings all over his room. And the first day I went to school, he died. And my mother tells me she thinks he died because I went to school, because I wasn't going to be there anymore. Like, she always said that he had lost the will to live before I was born, that everybody used to always say, oh, he has no will to live, he's going to go soon. I mean, that's what his friends and the family were saying. He just has nothing to live for. And then when I was born, he had something to live for. And my first day of school, he died. You know, so at least that's my mother's story about it. But he was interesting. He's the one that was studying to be a monk. He was going to take the vow of silence and everything. He was going to be a monk. And the abbot and the monastery told him, before you take your final vows, go out into the world for a month. He said, go to a movie theater, rent a room. And he gave him some money, whatever. And or he had some money, and he had a bank account or whatever before he was going into the monastery and taking the vow of poverty. And he came back a month later and said, I'm married. I met her. After the first week, I met a woman sitting next to me in a luncheonette, and it was love at first sight. We got married. And to add insult to injury to the Roman Catholic abbot, she was a Protestant. You know, so
go figure.
They always had a mixed marriage. In fact, one therapist told me that's probably the cause of all my mental illness, because they used to tell me in a Catholic school that all Protestants go to hell, they're down in the deepest pits, only, you know, and they used to tell me all these stories. And my grandmother was a Protestant. She lived two doors next door, and she was the most God-loving woman in the world. I mean, she was always filled with life and light and everything, and I couldn't believe in that. And that discrepancy probably caused all those early visions of in the church, of, you know, about crawl down the aisle on your hands and knees, all those crazy visions was somehow this terrible God that was going to throw my grandmother into hell because she wasn't a Catholic. You know, at least that's what one therapist believed.
What do you think of it?
I think it's probably very plausible. Probably is very plausible. And then I used to apply it like, well, my parents don't go to church, even though they send us to the Catholic school. They're going to hell, too. And I was always worried about hell, but that all these great loved ones that I had in my life were all going to hell. And, you know, it just blew my mind as a child. And, it was terrible. The Catholics early on, back then, they were terrible. They're not so bad anymore. I mean, they've lightened up, but they were terrible back then.
What does that say to you?
It says that that's probably also, even though it was terrible and a terrible thing as a child, it kind of impelled me to go searching for God, the true nature of God in all the religions of the world. Because then I kind of projected it. I said, well, if my grandmother's going to heaven and she's a Protestant, which is what I believed, and my mother's going to heaven because she's a good woman, even though she doesn't go to church, then maybe all the terrible pagans and the Gentiles and all these terrible people that they've been teaching us about, maybe they're going to heaven too. So I started searching in Hinduism and Buddhism. I mean, even early on, I read some of the things. At 15 years old, I was getting into that. So it kind of started me on my pursuit to study all the religions of God, and away from, even though I respect the Roman Catholic model to a certain extent, the traditions, not necessarily the superstitions about people going to hell if you're not a Roman Catholic, but I started respecting the traditions of all the religions. I mean, somehow that drew me to the Jewish religion, because they were always the worst, you know, offenders in the Catholic religion. You know, oh, the Jews, they put Jesus to death, and they're terrible, you know. I was always down in the Old Testament neck of the woods for that purpose, you know, for that reason, assuming that, well, if they love God, I mean, that they're going to heaven too, you know, and I started searching all the religions, you know, and that started me on my search. So you could say it was a terrible thing in my mind to grow as a child, all that these low people going to hell, but it impelled me on a search that I feel is never ending.
But I wonder about the thread of all these, the propaganda of all these religions about each religion makes a point.
Well, I just, it's strange. I just wrote a poem about that very subject last night, and it has to do with my interpretation of a very famous passage in an episode in the Bible called Belshazzar's Feast. He was like I think he was, I don't know if he was a Babylonian, he was, you know, one of the bad guys. And he was holding a feast, offering something to all the gods. Now, my interpretation when I read that, this is about 20 years ago, was that all these various gods stand for various religions and these images. And then the fingers of God, two fingers of God came and wrote on the wall saying, you know, basically condemning him. And I wrote a poem just last night that has to do with that these religions, these gods, call them religions. I mean, they serve their purpose, but the handwriting on the wall, that wall is basically separating us from God, and they've become the wall. The wall itself is the religions. At least that's the point. I can't talk these points very well, but I can write them into poetry sometimes. Okay. I think it would make a little more sense if you read it.
Do you mind reading it?
Yeah, hold on. It's called Oblation for God, the One of Sooth. And it goes, there was talk of many gods at Belshazzar's feast. Call them religions. Two fingers of one god wrote on the wall, separating us from him. Call these fingers commandments. The first, the second commandment. Honor no god before me, one, and make no image, two. These images, these religions, and these gods are that wall those fingers wrote upon to condemn, at least as they are constituted. For each one separates eventually rather than unifies, and God is a God of unity. Look at man and woman. Yeah, I have to find the right page. There is a time for separation between them, and there is a time of union. But when they must be separated par course, holding another in the heart is adultery. Only with this being understood, it is wise not to ignore his spokespersons, his religions, all of them. Was it not they who introduced the couple one to the other? And when they squabble, do they not intercede? But beyond this, when the couple wish to be alone intimately, they are only in the way. Does that make any sense?
Oh, I thought you were looking for another page.
What's that?
I thought you were looking for another page.
I did. I finished it. I read it. I read the whole thing.
Oh, okay. I thought it was, for some reason, I was trying to understand the squabbling part.
When the couple, I'm talking about the couple as implying like a god and the person, the man or woman. I'm applying the duality of man and woman as between man and God. And I said when a man has a squabble with God, he can the religions will intercede for him to a certain extent. He can fall back on them, but when they wish to be alone intimately, the religions just get in the way.
Meaning
that, you know, when you're alone with God, you have no need for the religions when you're at union. At least that's the point I'm trying to make.
I think it's confusing when you use the word couples, because I think of a man and woman.
Well, there's much talk in the Gospels about the bride and the bridegroom, and much talk in Old Testament prophecy of the bride and the bridegroom, about man and God as a divine bridegroom and man as kind of like his mate. So I think anybody who understood scriptures would understand that. Would understand my metaphor. You know, because, you know, like this book, basically, it could be read as it is, but I think an understanding of the Bible helps. You know, like God always talked to the Israelites as his spouse, in many ways, many times in the prophets, you know. So I think anybody who had a grasp of the scriptures would understand that. I could write a quote from the scriptures on the page, and maybe that would indicate it. You know what I mean? Like I could quote one of those lines about bride and bridegroom. As God speaking to, say, Israel, and put that on the page, and then a person reading the poem without an intimate grasp of scriptures would know what I'm talking about when I go to that metaphor of man and woman.
That might be, at least for me, might have made a difference in terms of not getting lost.
Well, what I'm saying is... I'm applying the union. But I mean, that's always the whole Bible is basically about that. The whole the union between man and woman is always kind of like seen as the union between humanity and God. I mean, the whole Bible is basically constructed on that principle. So I could write a quote for somebody who has no knowledge of that about the bride and the bridegroom.
Yeah, it might be.
But I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know, but I would have to find the right quote. And
so, could you read it to me once more?
Okay. Let me get the pages so I don't confuse you with the pages. There was talk of many gods at Belshazzar's feast. Call them religions. Two fingers of one god wrote on the wall separating us from him. Call these fingers commandments. The first, the second commandment. Honor no god before me, one, and make no image, two. These images, these religions, and these gods are that wall those fingers wrote upon to condemn, at least as they are constituted. For each one separates eventually, rather than unifies, and God is a god of unity. Look at man and woman. I know what I could do. It's look at man and woman in terms of him. There is a time for separation between them, and then there is a time of union. But when they must be separated, Paul, of course, holding another in the heart is adultery.
Only Go ahead.
Only with this being understood, it is wise not to ignore his spokespersons, his religions, all of them. Was it not they who introduced the couple one to the other? And when they squabble, will they not intercede? But beyond this, when a couple wish to be alone intimately, man and God, I could put this into the poem, wishes to be alone intimately, they're only in the way. Does that make more sense?
Yeah.
I could write it into the poem. I mean, this is just I just wrote this last night. I could write it into the poem, simplifying that matter.
You know, now that I've talked to you, I have a little clearer grasp of it.
Look at God, look at man and woman in terms of God and humanity.
Right.
You know, and I think that just that the addition of that one line would.
But I also think you might want to also look at your comment about adultery.
Well, holding another on the heart. Well, there's a. It's strange. That's one of the insights of Jesus. Like he was saying, adult. If you lust in the heart, that's even almost worse than lusting in the flesh. That goes to saying if you even look at another woman, you are committing adultery. So that's what I mean. I could put an asterisk on that line and put that quote on the page if that would you think that would help.
Yeah. Well, because I think the adultery is an interesting concept because it means that you're not being true.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, when you're separated, I said there's a time for unity, there's a time for separation, but when you're separated, holding another in the heart other than your rightful mate, your rightful spouse, is adultery.
But it's also the same thing for religion. You know, if you
I leave these all open, and they're meant to be thought about.
But sometimes
that's how I mean it in terms of religion. I'm saying holding another religion in the heart, the religion of just being with God.
Well, it might be helpful then, and I shouldn't suggest anything. That's why I don't. But just in this point, I will.
I think people will understand that. I mean, this is a poetic sense. I think people will understand that I'm not just now all of a sudden talking about man and woman and no longer talking about God and man.
But I think the Well, my thought...
I'm using a metaphor to bring it down to man and woman, the understanding of God and humanity.
But in the sense of holding another...
In the heart.
In the heart. And then in quotations, maybe another idol or religion.
Well, I think they'll understand that. I think that's kind of like... I can't make it too... That makes it too wordy. I think that if a person understands it, they understand it. If they don't understand it, just go to another poem.
Okay.
I think that would be understood. I mean, that's where the poetic sense within a person would have to take over.
Okay. I'm just trying, you know, I'm trying to understand it literally, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because...
you know, I think they would understand my metaphor once I apply... Consider man and woman in terms of God and humanity.
Well, also I'm recording.
They would have to apply everything I say about man and woman in those terms, in terms of religion. When I speak about the spokespersons as introducing them, like they do introduce you to God in the first place, but eventually they get in the way. That's the whole point of the poem.
Well, also keep in mind, I record everything.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to... clarify not only for myself but for anybody else who may have some questions about that.
Yeah, I don't really know that these are for I think these are only for people who, ultimately that they really have an understanding of scriptures. I don't like to be so select, but I feel this is the people who really understand this are the people who have read the scriptures like I have.
Well, fortunately, there aren't too many of you.
There's enough in there. It's kind of like Mozart. Mozart is accessible to just about everybody. But there are things in there for the scholar, for the true person with knowledge of music. There are things for him to appreciate in that, too. I try to make it accessible to all on certain levels, but I think there are certain points that you know, that the true student of words will understand.
Oh, I you have more faith than I do in this.
I mean
in language.
Ultimately, it's basically just for God. It's really not for man in the first place. You know, these are offered to God. It's my way of sharing my God with me. As I write, I mean, and if men are going to understand it, they'll understand it. If they don't, then it just goes by the way. It was my offering to God. That's all it was. That's how it began, and that's how it will end. You know, there are certain books, I mean, there are certain lines in the Quran. Like if you read them at first glance, that they're beautiful to look at, but to really understand them, you have to understand the workings of the word. You know, I've been working with these words for like 30 years, reading and writing. And there's a certain language in there. There's a certain sense. There's a certain poetic sense. And that's what I'm trying to explore in this book.
I
don't go anywhere near the literal. The literal is that's for the dead.
What?
You know what I mean? Like Jesus had a saying, leave the dead to bury the dead. I mean, the literal sense is the dead word. It's just the word. The poetic sense is everything. The spiritual sense is even more.
Well, that's thought-provoking.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of it in those terms. I don't know how the dead are going to bury the dead.
Well, you have to get the poetic sense of that. Because he's constantly fighting with people who took the literal sense of the law as their guidelines, and Jesus basically came by and he was exploring the spiritual sense of the law. And he even had a saying, spirit, not letter of the law. You know, and basically they crucified him because they didn't understand his sense of things. They didn't understand. They didn't really understand what he was doing. And I think it's meant to be. It was meant to be at that time. things are meant to be hidden. They're meant to be puzzles. It's not all meant to be blatant. But I'll take your advice on that one line, though. I will add that look at man and woman in terms of God and humanity. I think that will, if anybody was really interested in reading them, those are really only for people who are interested in reading them. If they're not, you know.
Well, we never know who is our audience anyway. We never know who's going to listen to these tapes.
I know, but the important thing is, to me, is that sense, a hidden spiritual poetic sense, that's what I'm trying to build in this book, and that's the whole book falls and rises on that, one way or the other, and I don't think it's meant to be accessible to all.
Well, you never know. You never know what things have in store, where they go.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, though, how you start this out as a commentary on the many religions, and yet.
Well, there's also a sense of the wall. Like,
right. The religions are the wall.
The religions are the wall, but that also applies to man and woman. Like, in the old fashioned sense, a woman has a certain wall, a seal, called the hymen, that separates man from her until basically she loses her virginity. And, there's a play on that, too.
Where is that?
Simply the wall. Earlier on in the book, I mentioned that to a certain extent. I mean, I think this is all symbolic language in our nature that applies to our relationship with God.
Hmm. Interesting. I wonder about. These walls.
I think they're meant to be there to a certain extent in the first place, and then they're meant to be broken down eventually, but only for the beloved. In other words, like in the old-fashioned sense, a woman would save her virginity until she met the man she loved, and then when they were married, that was the old-fashioned religious sense of it in the old-fashioned mores.
You know, that's very rarely.
That's very rarely done now, but I don't know that that's a good thing. I don't know. I think, like I was mentioning.
Well, even then, it was very rarely
done. I was mentioning last week at the college, I think that's why I like the old-fashioned Orthodox Jewish people. That's part of their charm, their quaintness. I'm sure those women practice that. Those Orthodox women.
I never, you know, I don't know what.
They don't have the chance. They're so. That's such a strong community. They don't have the chance to go outside. You know, to fool around with other people and other. I think they're very strict about all those things, and I know the Amish are too.
Yeah, but you know that there's always a backstory.
Yeah, but still, but that's the mores that's held up. I mean, that was the mores of the olden days, and I think there's something quaint, there's something very beautiful about that.
Well, you know, it's kind of like our fearless leader has just say no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our fearless leader.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole religion is just say no.
What do you mean, just say no?
Just say no to sex. And I think that's pretty delusional.
Yeah, well.
Asking a young person who's got their hormones all up and down and in another culture.
Well, that's he has free speech, I guess, right?
Who, God?
No, the president.
Yeah, but his free speech is often about limiting the other free speech. This free speech.
Well,
of others.
I don't want to get into George Bush now. This, my poem has nothing to do with George Bush.
Hey. George Bush is everywhere.
I'm not writing for George Bush. I'm not, you know.
George Bush.
What I'm saying is I do miss the old-fashioned values. I think there's something beautiful about them. We just threw them out the window without a shot being fired. We just threw them all out the window. And we think that the rock and roll ethos of just do whatever the hell you want and just, the old Beatles song, do it in a road. I mean, you know. I think there's something to old-fashioned mores and quaintness and the charm of the old-fashioned religions. I think that's something that's missing in humanity.
Yeah, but I think that a lot of those old-fashioned religions were really nightmares for. I think you romanticize them, but I think that in some ways they were nightmares for the people living in them.
Well, you know, you could say the sexual revolution is now the norm, but what has it left in its wake? Abortion. Not women just kill their children. They don't want their children. They don't want them. They just kill them.
But look at it from other points of view, that the sexual revolution. You know, we have a very. If you look at this country. It's a very religious country.
I don't know about that. I don't think it's religious anymore.
Have all these.
So I don't know. I don't know what planet you're coming from. I don't think this is a religious anymore at all.
I don't know.
I think that's what's missing in it.
Well, but look at this. Our fearless leader again, and who put him in power is the faith-based religious.
Well, would you have all executed Lynn Schott because they voted, because they're the ones that vote?
No, I'm just saying there was, I believe that the 2004 election was a religious war between
I think it was.
Secularism and
the
religion.
The reason why, I'll tell you right now, if I did vote in that election, I would have voted for George Bush because he was against abortion. Not because of his social policies, not because of fundamentalist religion. I like with fundamentalist religion to that extent that they do teach right or wrong. And to me, abortion, that's why I'm not going to vote in this election, because there's nobody going to be running on. He had the guts to stand up against abortion when it wasn't popular. And that I respect him. I didn't like what he did in Iraq. I don't think he had any business going over there bothering those people. But, that doesn't mean I still like his stand on abortion. I respect Cheney's stand on abortion. You know, that's just where I'm at. I'm very much against abortion.
Yeah, but that's that. But
that's really what it comes down to. I mean, that's what the sexual revolution, rather than producing a child, has produced the death of the womb. Now a womb produces death rather than life. That's what the sexual revolution has done in my eyes.
Well, you know,
it has turned things around. I mean, you could say the old religions were nightmares, but what is the new religion? What is the new rock? What is the rock and roll, TV, computer revolution? What has it brought about? Has it enriched man? I think it's enslaved into these things. Like I say, I don't know if there's an electric plug in heaven. I don't know if there's going to be an electric plug where I want to go.
Well, if I have anything to do with it.
Well, maybe you don't.
Hey. you are.
Well, anyway, so I'm going to get off now and leave you to your dartboard with George Bush on the center, and I'm going to just get off and relax. Okay.
You can't relax.
I always relax.
Well, you're forgiven.
Okay, so I'll be talking to you, Gio. Take care now.
Okay, and you sure you don't want to come today?
I don't think so. I want to kind of get up early. I don't want to have to go on 3 hours sleep when I finally do go to the doctors. I don't want to have to be on 3 hours sleep because I'll be irritable all day. You know, so I kind of want to get a good night's sleep tonight, and what, even if whether I go or not, I want to get a good night's sleep and get to sleep early.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
So I'll be talking to you, Gio.
Yeah, sounds good, David.
Okay.
Good
Take
talking.
Care.
Ciao.